So in this session, I mean, this session is called Turbulent Cascades and Dissipation. We've sort of organized it as follows. The first half is on direct cascades in MHD. For some reason, we're not considering hydrodynamic, purely hydrodynamic turbulence. We've got magnetic fields and everything. We have four speakers, actually. I'll say something about what I know of direct cascades and MHD turbulence. Then Jason Mehran will show you the results of many simulations he's done. Okay, they're the finest simulations I've seen of MHD turbulence. Okay, so definitely, I mean, there's a lot of phenomena there that I don't understand. It's opened up many. And I think Eve has been included as a last minute speaker, as something to. Where's she? Okay, she's. Okay, we should call her. She has something to present on direct cascades in the molecular clouds. It's a sort of remark, follow up remark of the talk she gave a couple of days back. Then Elliot has something to say on dissipation in direct cascades. And then we move on to inverse cascades in dynamos. The session, I mean, most of today has seen discussions on dynamos. And when we planned this, we thought we'd have a small session on this just to sort of emphasize that, while one talks of the alpha effect and tries to calculate alpha in many ways, also this very difficult problem of trying to match scales from driving to large scales in a sort of continuous fashion. And what one sees in numerical simulations does imply some sort of continuous transfer, though I think we don't know if it can be thought of as a local phenomenon in K-space. Ben has something to say on the theory, and Axel on simulations. I think Dinsha Balsara offered to show us more some recent results of his on inverse cascades. And then George Field will sum up direct cascades, inverse cascades, and the wind of the session. Okay. So that's how much time we have. Okay. Seven for discussion, the main talk, and five for discussion. Some get a little less time, not because they have anything less interesting to say, but they've been enrolled somewhat late. Okay? So, yeah. So I'll say something on alpha turbulence. Okay, that's what I've worked on, and say something quick. Okay? So the system we are dealing with is incompressible MHC. The first is the momentum equation, induction, and incompressibility. I've written the dissipative terms in the conventional fashion using isotropic diffusivities, but in practice, one should be much more careful. Even in the collisional regime, you have tensor viscosities in a plasma, and when the cascade enters, when very small scales are created and things become collisionless, things get even more complicated. So I'll sort of drop. Henceforth, I won't keep writing these dissipative terms and assume that there is some sort of dissipation that takes over on very small scales. Okay, I won't specify what it is. So it's convenient to deal with the dynamics in terms of this variables introduced by Elsasser, the velocity plus minus magnetic field. Here's a factor, 4 pi times the mass density, which is a constant in an incompressible fluid. So we just think of these u plus and u minus as velocity plus minus magnetic field. Okay, it's a very funny combination, as Elsasser himself commented, that u plus and u minus are neither polar nor axial vectors. Okay. So the symmetries are unclear. He didn't know what the status was. So written in terms of SS variables, the equations assume a particularly symmetric form. Okay, this is known since 1950. Okay, Elsesser himself, he looked at these equations, compared them to hydrodynamic equation, and said, well, turbulence in this kind of a system might well mimic hydrodynamic turbulence. And he had further comments to offer on the dissipative terms, which I haven't written. Okay. So I will consider a very specific situation, which is to start with an unperturbed state which is static and which has a mean magnetic field of strength P0 in the z direction. So I'll get rid of densities henceforth by defining the aspirin speed d sub a. Okay. So imagine that the system is perturbed, stirred, maybe in velocities, and I've written the perturbed Elsesser variables as W plus and minus. Okay. The unperturbed state only contributes to the magnetic field. Okay, so this is the system you're going to look at. Oh, someone should time me. Yeah, that's right. 2 minutes? No.
Why is that 1 minute?
Seven after I started on Alfin Tub. Okay, not introducing speaker. Okay. So the equations are rewritten there with W plus and minus as perturbations about the mean field. The terms on the left hand side, on the left side, are just linear terms. And the truly nonlinear terms are on the right hand side. Okay. So it's very clear that to have anything other than linear wave, non-dispersive waves traveling through the system, you need interaction between W plus and W minus. If you were to create only one kind of wave, you know, you set W plus equal to zero, just by choosing V equal to minus V, then W minus assumes this, has this very general solution. It's a waveform that's created at one time that travels, you know, without changing its shape, along the magnetic field. And similarly for W minus. So you should think of W plus and minus as, or W minus and W plus as waves that travel up and down magnetic fields. Okay, the opposite kind of wave is not there. It's a nonlinear solution that doesn't change its form. So no turbulence, no cascade, nothing. You've created a kind of solitary wave. Okay. The people contributed decisively to thinking in MSC turbulence, Kraepelin and Eroshnikov. Kraepelin contributed some of the deepest ideas in this. Realized that turbulence is due to interaction between W plus and W minus, and that you can't get rid of the effect of a mean field. Meaning, here you have to contrast the situation with hydrodynamics, where the effect of a large eddy can be transformed away by moving to its frame. Okay, so that interactions between on small scales are not really mediated by the large scale flow. Here you have waves traveling in opposite directions, and it's clear that no Galilean transformation can get rid of both kinds of waves. So the effect of the large scale remains. Okay, and then Kraepelin and Eroshnikov independently, of course, looked at homogeneous isotropic turbulence in this system. They postulated that the turbulence would be isotropic. And when you work through the effect of collisions between waves, the physical picture is you have wave packets of positively directed waves and negatively directed waves. Two wave packets collide, change in form a little bit. Let's say positive wave meets another negative wave, changes still further, and the perturbations build up randomly till the perturbations grow to order unity and you created smaller scales. Okay. If you assume that the process is isotropic, for a weak excitation, the spectrum worked out in a twiddly fashion turns out to go as 1 over k, which is a wave number, over 7 halves. To be con- what?
Is that correct?
Yeah. In, to be contrasted with 11 thirds, which you obtain in the hydrodynamic case. Okay? So if you work out the strength of the interactions, you know, how nonlinear the interactions are, a measure of that is the wave period divided by cascade time. It scales as 1 over k power half. So from this Twiddly estimate, you would conclude that you've got a self-consistent system where as you go to larger and larger k's, the interaction gets weaker and weaker. So what was assumed in the beginning, that the interactions are weak, continues to hold as you go down the inertial range. Okay? Unfortunately, it's impossible to put this in a formal set of equations. Okay? And it's hard for me to go into the reasons, but I'll describe what happens if you try to set it up formally. What looks like an innocuous assumption that the cascade is isotropic turns out to be completely false. Okay, you set up an excitation that's isotropic on some large scale little l, amplitude v sub l, which is much smaller than the alpha and speed. The spectrum seems to evolve in a manner that preserves k parallel. As if you can't create finer scales in directions parallel to the magnetic field. So you create small scales in the perpendicular direction, okay, and sort of indicated in which direction the energy transfer occurs in k-space. So you work out the three-dimensional spectrum, careful to distinguish k-perp and k-parallel. You get a spectrum that goes as 1 over k-perp cube, and what's really interesting is that if you work out the small parameter, which is the wave period by the interaction time, it is proportional to k. So as you go down the inertial range to smaller and smaller perpendicular scales, the interactions get stronger. Okay. So it sort of self-consistently blows up. Yes, sir? 0 minutes. And I should stop. So any questions, I can say something about the strong turbulence. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I do have something to say on that. Yes. Okay. So you've gone to small scales where interactions are of order unity. It's hard to analyze this case because a wave period is of order the interaction time itself. But it's easy enough to postulate that once that happens, this kind of the strength of the interaction might saturate. Okay, so regard that as a postulate, not been proved. Okay? So you said the linear wave period equal to the nonlinear interaction time, okay, which is the strain rate due to the opposite kind of waves. Then if you assume, you know, like also Kolmogorov did, that there is a scale independent flux of energy to smaller perpendicular scales. Lambda over there indicates perpendicular scales. Okay. Then 1 and 2 imply that now the parallel scales can grow as perpendicular scale to power 2/3 in a somewhat weak manner. Okay, it doesn't quite keep up with the perpendicular scale. And that the RMS velocity fluctuation on some small scale lambda scales as lambda to 1/3. So it's like an anisotropic Kolmogorov cascade. Okay. If looked at in the perpendicular scales. So this is the energy spectrum, and I've just indicated how k parallel can sort of weakly grow.
Is it defined by small point k square?
Pardon?
Defined by small point k square?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So that's all I have to say on this. Yeah. Yeah.
A very easily defined problem in this whole field. Oh, and suppose you have one of these arbitrary localized disturbances, propagating to the left, and another localized disturbance propagating to the left. And for a certain time, they overlap and interact in a nonlinear manner. But then something emerges after the calculation process.
Yes.
Have you thought about that problem, and so what happens?
We don't have a situation which is homogeneous.
No,
it's two wave packets interacting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, both emerge by the
base. On the consequences of these fairly simple approaches, and the fact that we have these nonlinear solutions
as a starting point. Yeah. One can make one general statement, which is that the energies in these wave packets are preserved.
Yeah.
You can't exchange energies.
Yeah.
To lowest order, right? To lowest order, you can do that. Yes. That there are interactions.
But
the lowest order,
no exchange of energy. You can call them solitary waves, yes. I mean, but they're not very special because you could, once you've chosen, let's say, the velocity equal to the magnetic field, you can choose the spatial form at an initial time, quite arbitrarily, and then it just goes down.
I'm sorry we have to cut off this discussion with our chairman.
Yes, sir.
We've already satisfied
concrete, the magnetic field points to Z, and I'll refer to the two directions of Alphane wave propagation as up and down, and I'll refer to the length scales as transverse to B and longitudinal to B. So the anisotropy is the elongation of wave mode structures in the direction of B, and it's built into the grid. The simulations are incompressible and spectral because for scintillation, high beta is what applies. Now, Sridhar introduced the concept of inequality between the longitudinal and the transverse timescales. This is the timescale for cascade, the transverse size divided by the fluctuating velocities, and this is the longitudinal timescale, the wave mode period, the longitudinal size of the wave divided by the Alphane propagation speed. So we need ways of quantifying these quantities in the data, which we do with structure functions. The structure function should be defined in the local magnetic field frame, which are ways of relating the Alphane fluctuations as a function of scale displacement. There's a transverse scale, which is transverse to the local direction of B, and the longitudinal scale, which we obtain by integrating along B. So setting this is the transverse structure function as a function of the transverse scale, and the longitudinal structure function as a function of the longitudinal scale. Setting them equal is an implicit relationship between the longitudinal and the transverse scales. And it also relates them to the difference in fluctuations, which are implicitly a function of scale. So the test of the scaling is to plot the ratio of this and this as a function of scale. And we find that the theory is triumphantly validated in the code. This is the ratio of those two scales as a function of transverse, as we go deeper into the cascade. This is the outer scale, and this is the inner scale. So this is the range at which the simulation is unaffected by viscosity.
Yeah, I know these distributions are K-parallel. Which
lambda parallel do you pick out? Lambda parallel? Well, I plotted them as a function of lambda transverse. Am I understanding your question?
Well, yeah, well, I get a whole band of excited.
The Fourier space power spectrum structure forms a cone heading out towards the transverse direction. It expands, but I really don't have time to worry about that here. We do have pictures of that so that you can see the full Fourier space structure as a function of transverse coordinate, transverse k, and longitudinal k. There is also an implied relationship between the longitudinal scale and the transverse scale, which is 2/3 according to the scaling. The actual value is more like 0.8, and that's because of other effects which are on the next transparency. This is the power spectrum of the Alphane fluctuations as a function of the transverse wave vector. And this is the power spectrum of the up Alphane waves and the power spectrum of the down Alphane waves. And this reflects the amount of inertial range that we have where the aliasing occurs here, and the hyperviscosity takes away the energy before it gets to the dealiasing. And we find the slope, which is shallower than Kolmogorov. In these units, a Kolmogorov spectrum would have an index of 5/3. And the reason for the shallowing of this slope is because there are three spatial effects which go beyond the scalings. So the Goldreich-Schreedhart scalings are the correct first step in this problem, but there's more going on, and so what it actually ends up looking bad like is quite different. These three mechanisms make it possible for us to have energy in the system without cascade. Now this has no bearing on the molecular cloud energy decay simulations because that regime is far from here, is completely different from here. The first one which I call imbalance. It's possible for the two Alphane directions, the up and the down waves, to have different energies, and if that which applies directly to solar wind turbulence. And if that happens, the rule is that only oppositely directed waves interact with each other. So if we were to derive a Kolmogorov-style scaling based on a constant of energy flux through all scales, we have to make the distinction between what is being cascaded and the agent of cascade. So if we derive the scaling for the up waves, which are red, we would have the energy flux of the up waves is equal to the energy of the up Alsasser field divided by the cascade time scale. And for the cascade time scale, we should use the thing which is doing the cascading, which is the down waves. And so you put the down Alsasser magnitude here. And you do the inverse thing to relate the scaling for the down waves. Now this transforms into power spectrum structure, looks like this. Now, if the energies in the two Alsasser fields were equal, then you could put these together and just have it be an E, and you would have something that would look like Kolmogorov. But if the energies were different, and you used that Kolmogorov-like scaling, you would get the wrong answer for the coefficient, which relates, the dimensionless coefficient, which relates the cascade flux to the energy in the cascade. It turns out that when the energies are unequal in the two wave mode directions, it's unstable to imbalance, where the wave mode direction which has more energy more quickly cascades the direction which has less energy, and the result is the lesser energy direction is eliminated, leaving behind the direction with greater energy. This is for decaying turbulence. It is possible for forced turbulence can restore the imbalance after it starts off. But if you look at the turbulence at any given point in time, you will find that the two directions can be unequal in energy by up to a factor of 5. And so if you want a total spectrum, how many minutes?
5
for the discussion. Okay, 2 more effects, which if you want to know about, you have to ask me about. Otherwise, lots of good controversial stuff, too.
What about intermittency?
Why, thank you, George. I'm glad you asked. Now, this is the second mechanism for us to have energy without cascade. The hydrodynamic analogy does not apply where, although intermittency exists there, if there is energy, there is cascade because they go together. But for alphane turbulence, it's possible for the wave packets to be different. These are the upward traveling packets, the red ones, and the green ones are the downward traveling packets. It's possible for them to miss. And so if the intermittency was quite extreme, you would have localized pieces of packets which would only occasionally interact with each other. And we find in the simulations that the intermittency gets more extreme as you go to smaller scale.
It's not true that in ordinary hydrodynamic turbulence, if you have energy, it must cascade. The counterexample is the perfectly uniform state. For example, ABC, where there's no nonlinear steady state, no matter how high the Reynolds number is.
That's certainly true.
Unstable, what?
It is. It's unstable to vortex to stretching. Does anyone want to know about the third? Of course you do. The third mechanism I call polarization, where it's where the best way to explain it is just in terms of pictures. Now this is an alphane wave packet which is propagating upward, and we're looking at the fluctuations in the transverse plane to B. And this is a wave packet propagating downward, and we're looking at its fluctuations in a plane perpendicular to B. Imagine if the fluctuations in the up packet are principally in the X direction, and the fluctuations in the downward traveling packet are principally in the Y direction. Then, when they collide with each other, and the rule is, there's two equivalent rules, the up waves advect the down waves. The other equivalent rule is the down waves follow the field lines of the up waves. It's clear that these two are going to distort each other. So oppositely polarized alphane waves in opposite directions interact. Now, if on the other hand, I had alphane waves where both the up and the down propagating waves were polarized in the same direction, it's clear that these are going to push each other in the X direction, but the final configuration is not going to look any different from the initial configuration. And so the conclusion is only alphane waves which are oppositely directed and oppositely polarized interact. In a decaying simulation, the polarization is unstable, where an initially unpolarized turbulence develops toward polarization. Forced turbulence can restore the polarization, but if you look at any given realization, you see heavy fluctuations in polarization. And furthermore, if you start a large eddy which is polarized, that polarization is remembered as it cascades to small scale. And so if the outer scale forcing situation had a component of polarization to it, such as in a shear galactic disk, you would see that effect propagated to the small scale.
These are all alphane waves.
There are rules for the slow mode cascade, which I'm not going to treat here. Yes?
But are you saying that modes of similar polarization in fact do not interact, not linearly, that would be
Modes of which kinds of waves?
Similar, the alphane wave is the same.
For these two? They do interact non-linearly, but the structures are not changed, and so you wouldn't know.
But isn't there a cascade of smaller scales? Nevertheless,
no. If you look at the Elsasser advection operator, it is in fact zero, because you need a gradient in the y direction to do something to this.
Z plus up red, Z minus up red. I would ask the question, what would happen happen if I put in a small perturbation of the symmetry, and all this will go away, is that true?
I'm saying the situation is unstable to the development of imbalance and polarization. Because if one of them has more energy, one polarization, it more effectively cascades the components which have the other polarization. Then it is itself cascaded.
In a real turbulent situation, the energies that continually encounter the wave packet will continually encounter new wave packets that we've never seen before.
That's right. That's why the box size is 256 transverse elements and 512 longitudinal elements, because I wanted to have several interactions and cascades of the outer scale eddies before they cycled themselves around the box. So that by the time they come around to the same place in the box again, they're seeing new stuff.
Okay, I think I have considerably less than 5 plus 5 minutes worth to say, which probably will make everyone happy since we're getting towards late time. So what I wanted to do was follow up on some of the confusion I probably created during my talk on Tuesday. And there what I was discussing was one of the things that I mentioned was the spectrum for strong turbulence, where in strong turbulence we mean turbulence which has nonlinear amplitudes. And so coming back to what I was discussing there, this is back in molecular cloud land, where the Mach numbers are very large, characteristically. So these simulations related to Mach number of 5, and what I'm showing here is a comparison of the power spectra for cases of a strong mean magnetic field and weak mean magnetic field, where that means that in units of the thermal sound speed, the Alfvén speed is on the large scale field is equal to that or 10 times that. So what you're seeing here is the power spectra in the magnetic field in the bottom panels and the power spectrum in the velocity field. And the basic thing that I wanted to show you was that when you have a weak mean field, you end up having, unlike in this case that we've just been hearing about, instead of having this anisotropic cascade, you have an isotropic cascade, basically because the motions are so nonlinear, factor 5 compared to the mean field, that it doesn't look Alfvénic at all. It just looks like a system, basically a system of shocks. So it ends up being isotropic in case space. Because what? Oh, these are small scales.
Well, these small scales would have become incompatible.
Yes, if you went to very, very small scales, you would have to approach this, but we're not on such small scales. Now, on the other hand, looking at the case where there's a stronger mean magnetic field, in the sense that the large scale Alfvén speed and large scale field is large compared to the velocity dispersion, then you do see this kind of anisotropic cascade that we've been hearing about, which is due to these Alfvén wave interactions. So what you can look at here is the shape of these contours in K-space. Where is their power? The power extends to farther in the perpendicular direction than in the parallel direction. So I just plotted for reference what an isotropic spectrum would look like. The what? The axis ratio? I don't know exactly. It doesn't change that much with K. You'd expect it to change as you go over a very large range of K, certainly. Okay, so that was my point of clarification. If there's any other questions, yes?
You've certainly demonstrated anisotropy, and we also get similar results. Have you demonstrated that actually is due to the Alfvén wave cascade, though?
Not directly, no. So it's,
so you're just saying that you get an anisotropy.
You get an anisotropy.
That's consistent with what's
and I mean, in the limit of an incredibly strong field, which is this other limit you might think of, you'd have anisotropy in the other direction. So you can think of this as, suppose you made the field, you know, completely rigid. You could only have motions along the field, and then you'd extend the power spectrum along the field because you'd develop shocks which are only propagating along the field. So in the limit of a very strong magnetic field, you would end up extending in the other direction. So what? What do you mean, tilt? Oh, so the perturbation, the field strength perturbation is about 4 in these units.
The delta D over
3 years. Right, so it's less than a half. Right, but when you get to these smaller scales, of course, that's not the case. Okay, that was all I wanted to say. Well, that's what this is.
That's
what this is. So this is.
So this is. About
yeah, I mean, well, not quite. So that's 60, 120. Okay, exactly 2 to 1. 60, 120. But that depends on the. It depends on the. It should extend. It should become more extreme as you go to larger k.
Yeah.
When
you analyze the power spectrum, when you take your axes, rather than perpendicular to the local.
No. So this is just along the larger.
Similar analysis by Ichiro and Kishina. Where you know, they took Fourier transform just along the mean initial mean magnetic field and perpendicular to it. This show came independent analysis. It's easy enough to think of it, to think of long eddies stretched along the local magnetic field direction. And so, because the k's are so limited in the larger direction, any tilt of the eddie would. Contribute largely to the parallel direction and suppress the analytical.
I asked this question because I shouldn't hear a paper I wrote in 1967 on the suppression of turbulence by a suddenly applied magnetic field. But that was in a lower magnetic Reynolds method from it. Once it worked it out, I started with isotropic turbulence, and then sure enough it becomes an isotropic disease. And it does in terms of a state in which becomes, the parallel energy is twice the transverse energy. I mean,
the parallel energy is larger than the transverse.
Well,
that's what I was suggesting. And if you took this limit of a very strong field, you end up with just having motions along the field and nothing perpendicular. So that would be elongated in the other direction. Sorry? About, no. I mean, well, in part, you know, it's turbulent, so it's some of each. It's a potpourri. We could, but we haven't yet.
So I'll just say a little bit about the question of what happens to this energy in the cascade as it goes to smaller and smaller scales. How's it finally dissipated? And perhaps not totally surprisingly, the answer depends on the problem. If one is in a partially ionized medium, then actually ion-neutral collisions are the dominant dissipation mechanism. And so, for instance, in the interstellar medium, I guess the scale is hundredth of a parsec or something, where dissipation can become important. I'm actually going to focus on the case where you have fully ionized medium, and at least for the, you know, in principle here, one can still have viscous and resistive dissipation of the modes as they propagate to small scales can still be important. But certainly for all the practical cases that I've put in, the interstellar medium, the solar wind, solar corona, accretion disk models, the waves essentially become collisionless before they reach the effective viscous or resistive dissipation scale. So by collisionless, I mean that they get to such low frequencies or such large wave vectors, such high frequencies or such large wave vectors that there's no collisions over the course of a wavelength or over the course of a mode period. So one's really interested then in the question of how is the energy dissipated in a collisionless plasma. And so this is another rendition of this perpendicular cascade, a kind of a schematic plot of the parallel and perpendicular directions with respect to the magnetic field. All of the energy lies in this cone at large perpendicular wave vectors and relatively small parallel wave vectors. The reason this is interesting from the dissipation point of view is that this means that the frequency of the turbulence is well below the proton cyclotron frequency, even when the perpendicular wave vectors become comparable to the proton Barmore wave. The reason this is important is this is basically, I'll discuss in a second, this is when collisionless processes start to become important, and the frequency of the turbulence is still very low in this kind of quasi perpendicular cascade, even at a very large wave vector. So the dissipation mechanisms of relevance here are basically wave particle resonances. So there's some general condition which says basically that you have a mode of a given frequency, a given parallel wave vector, and you're looking at particles of a certain cyclotron frequency and parallel velocity along the magnetic field. This is the resonance condition, which basically says that the Doppler shifted frequency of the wave, so the frequency of the wave in a frame moving along with the particle, when that's an integer multiple of the cyclotron frequency of the particle, you have a phase coherent or a resonant interaction. And that's when you exchange energy between particles and waves in collisionless plasma. The reason that the low frequency relative to the proton cyclotron frequency, and hence the electron cyclotron frequency, is relevant for this problem is it restricts what resonances are relevant. Namely, it restricts one to the Landau or the Chernyankov resonance, where the phase speed of the wave equals the speed of particle. And basically there's two, I think this is probably well known to many people, an example of this, of dissipation at this resonance is Landau damping, where you have a parallel electric field associated with the wave, which resonates with the particles, and you damp a wave by that means. There's an analog of this mechanism if you have compressional perturbations in a magnetic field. It's called transit time damping, and it's basically a collisionless version of Fermi acceleration, where magnetic compression associated with waves couple to the particle's magnetic moment and damp the energy out of the wave. The reason that one gets a cascade of energy at very small scales in alphanic turbulence is because for large wavelengths relative to the proton Larmor radius, these are both zero for an alphane wave. So there is no dissipation, linear collisionless dissipation in the MHD regime. You only get dissipation when you approach the proton Larmor radius and corrections to MHD start to become important. So basically, the upshot in terms of the physics that when the energy approaches scales of the proton Larmor radius, maybe a factor of 10 above the proton Larmor radius, maybe a factor of 10 below, it depends on the problem one is interested in, but that's when the dissipation starts to become strong by collisionless effects, and exactly which mechanism or which particle species is responsible for the dissipation depends primarily on beta, the ratio of the gas pressure to the magnetic pressure. In large beta plasma, the protons dissipate the waves. on scales with proton monomer radius. In small beta plasma, the electrons do the dissipation. And so this is kind of a general discussion if there's any questions about applications to specific situations, we can discuss those.
And can we work out on the effects of diffusivity for these two mechanisms?
You mean a momentum diffusion?
Well, so yeah, I suppose, I mean, I figured the equation, the induction equation for momentum.
Right.
Normally, you have a nice E by L squared.
Yes.
Now, you've got a complex process. Can they somehow be summarized?
Right.
Effective or something else.
I haven't looked into that. I know people have done this. Do you know? I mean. Yeah, I think you can use that to create effective.
This is the equation
that we
derived with the gyro of Yeah. That's right. There's a quantity of equations. The economic coefficient is designed by the linear theory. We put in a discussive design to reach the post-mag dynamics.
Yes.
Okay. It's ad hoc, though. So we know it works.
Yes.
It's certainly important for people like me who work with the continuum equation to know, after all this physics, what are the fundamental equations we should be trying to solve?
Yes.
In the very large paper, there's that question coming in. Is there a difference between the operating rate and the fully operating rate?
They looked at this in the MHD, not in kinetic theory, and the answer was no. Is there a... Right, oh, okay, I'm sorry. In that sense, yeah, that's one way to understand why the Alfheng wave develops a parallel magnetic field perturbation. Yes. It's essentially, I mean, it's the same thing, like you can understand Landau-Damping as... Yes, that's right. So that's one way, yes. I think so, yes. Yes. So it's the electron that he did would be the implication. It means that the models with very low electron heating rates are certainly problematic. Yeah. So you have to appeal to some other physics. The accretion rate has to be much smaller than usually assumed. Yes.
Yes, I'm going to say a few words about something similar to what George Field talked about this morning, inverse cascades, but one difference will be I will not be talking about a situation in which there's a mean field, so no mean field, and just a couple definitions. The magnetic helicity, an integral of vector potential dotted with magnetic field, it measures the interlockedness of field lines. It can also be expressed as an integral over its spectrum. And then you have kinetic helicity, sort of interlockedness of vorticity lines. And the basic idea behind an inverse cascade is if you stir your medium at some scale, injecting energy and helicity of either kinetic or magnetic form at some scale, you can have a forward or normal cascade of energy to small scales, but an inverse cascade to larger scales of magnetic helicity. Because the helicity, magnetic helicity, is associated with some magnetic energy, you also see a feature extending to larger scales in the magnetic energy spectrum. So what are just a couple key concepts behind the inverse cascade? Let me try to just give a cartoon here. The idea here being, imagine starting with a situation in which you have input of energy and only kinetic helicity at some wave number k naught. developing a roughly equipartitioned magnetic and energy spectrum extending to small scales, so a forward cascade of energy. What can happen is that the inputted kinetic helicity can generate magnetic helicity, but it can't generate any net magnetic helicity. So it can generate, say, positive magnetic helicity at large K, and the opposite sign at smaller K, so that the sum is zero. In an infinite system. There's another important thing here, that there's this inequality that the magnetic helicity spectrum must satisfy. For a given amount of magnetic energy, there's a maximum amount of magnetic helicity that you could have. The total amount of magnetic energy that you have is constrained basically by the amount you input in the forward cascade. So you can get only a maximum amount of magnetic helicity for that energy spectrum. But then what can give you an inverse cascade here? Well, to get an inverse cascade, you somehow have to increase, say, this peak here. How can you do that? Well, the way you do it is resistivity will decrease your small-scale magnetic helicity here, preferentially because it works better at small scales. Now, the fluid can then act to push you back up to the maximally helical state by ideal motions, generating more positive helicity here, but at the same time, the fluid motions will generate some extra negative helicity at larger scales. And that's the basic inverse cascade process in an infinite medium where you ignore the boundary conditions. So when you go back up to this maximally helical state at small scales, you add some extra helicity at large scales. So you go up to a new plot here, more negative helicity at large scales, which is associated with this tail of the energy spectrum going to small k. The key point is this. The rate at which you're adding this large-scale helicity is basically the rate at which you destroy the negative helicity by resistivity. Resistivity is small, so it's a slow process. In fact, the rate at which you destroy helicity is this integral over k space with k squared eta, a to the resistivity, times the spectrum here. And so the rate at which this can proceed, you can estimate it if you know some form of the helicity power spectrum. And so now I just want to give a basic argument that emerged from some conversations I've had at this conference with Sridhar and George Field, Axel Brandenburg, and Inshal Balsara for this maximum rate at which you can have an inverse cascade build up large-scale helicity. Here's the rate at which you're destroying magnetic helicity at small scales. The maximal rate you can destroy it is plugging in the maximum value of this spectrum, which is E over K. Pick your favorite value of the magnetic energy spectrum. The standard result for an isotropic spectrum gives you that the time to double your large-scale helicity scales like the 3/4 power of your Reynolds number if viscosity equals resistivity. But for a perhaps more realistic astrophysical plasma in a diffuse ISM, you'd have the parallel ion viscosity for a fully ionized region, parallel ion viscosity much larger than perpendicular viscosity. One other point. This is dominated by the smallest scales in the spectrum, this resistive destruction of the field. So you want to know what basically limits the small-scale dissipation of helicity. In a fully ionized medium of high magnetic Prandtl number, based on the parallel ion viscosity, it turns out that you cut off the slow mode at a comparatively large scale, the pseudo-alphane polarization. This is a somewhat technical point, but interesting perhaps to a couple of specialists in the audience. You need both the polarizations to have helicity, both the pseudo-alphane mode polarization and the shear alphane mode polarization. If you cut one of them off at some comparatively large scale, that will seriously limit your dissipation of helicity, and so this process is even smaller, and the scaling goes like the linear power of the magnetic Reynolds number. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, am I being sort of missing the point here if I think of this inverse cascade as the alpha effect? You're really talking about moving helicity up to the larger scale.
It's somehow intimately connected in a way I don't fully understand, but there is one basic difference. In the alpha effect, you typically have a separation of scales between turbulent scales and a much larger magnetic field. This here doesn't appeal to that. This would be a continuum of scales gradually inching up to larger and larger scales over time.
Are you talking about solar system?
Absolutely, yeah. And this is a key point that... Right. I think absolutely. This is a point that I think you emphasized in your review paper, and George and Eric have been emphasizing. This is you have to. This is if you throw away the outgoing the boundary terms.
I just comment that
Sure.
Your everything you say is certainly consistent with what I was trying to say this morning. But if you have a closed system, helicity cannot escape from the surface, then you have to carry out the dissipation as you explained. And I think your first formula is consistent with what I was trying to say, except that you are taking into account the spectrum. Remember, I estimated this lambda j dot b term divided by b bar squared by just taking the value at the outer scale. What you've done is carefully evaluate the effect of going through the entire inertial
Right. There's another difference that this is purely an upper limit, which relied on this assumption that the magnetic helicity spectrum would say equal to this maximal value, which gives you an upper limit. Axel has some simulations where he finds that it does actually approach that maximal value, so maybe it's better than an upper limit.
I'm troubled with calling it an inverse cascade, actually, because if this is like an alpha. You have it then the position at which you get maximum growth rate at large scales is determined simply by the effect of alpha and the turbulent exhibit, the beta. And it's the square root of beta over alpha. So that may be very much greater. You get it in one leap, not a succession of steps, which I normally think of when you use the word cascade.
Well, this is exactly the inverse cascade picture. Are you saying that this is not an inverse cascade?
I agree with your viewpoint fully, and my explanation that I'm going to present later, expecting to see also this gradual river, which I actually do see, but then I actually look at the input at the largest base number, at the full segment, largest scale. Actually, most of the input really comes actually from the forking scale, and to my surprise, not from the next dynamo scale takers too. So I was very surprised, and show there. So that seems to suggest that first of all, the alpha effect and inverse cascade are not the same thing if you take this as the distinction. Alpha effect means non-local transport, or non-local inverse cascade, and the inverse cascade in the narrow sense means local.
Right, and these inequalities here are based upon the sort of local sense, not the mean field dynamo sense of a non-local transport of energy. This kind of argument is based upon the sort of gradual creeping up in scale.
Based on a very brief comment that you made last night while I was talking to someone else who was there, you indicated just what you said now. So I went back and read the Fouquet paper on this point. And in fact, she's very explicit about calling it a nonlinear cascade because she implies that it is in fact a local interaction. And that each step in wave number space creates a local alpha in effect, which then affects the next step in wave number space. I now think on the basis of the simulation, that's simply wrong. It's not what you would call or I would call it a nonlinear cascade. It really is operating on the alpha, which is predominantly at the input scale.
First of all, the contribution to the present discussion of the inverse cascade. And in the later afternoon with Keith, I will concentrate on what it actually means in terms of the alpha effect, whether we can extract something like an alpha effect from the simulations. Before I actually come to the real dynamo calculations, where I have the forcing, I want to make 2 points about the decay calculations. First of all, I find one particularly clear example where I can distinguish between the presence of an inverse cascade and the absence of an inverse cascade, and it has to do only with the fact that there is magnetic helicity in the system. If there's no magnetic helicity in the system, net magnetic helicity in the system, that may be random, I don't see an inverse cascade in a decay calculation. So the decay calculation is a clear-cut case. In all other cases, you may find buildup of energy at larger scales even without net helicity. So here's the comparison. I mean a calculation in this particular case where I start off with a random power spectrum of magnetic energy. Then the magnetic energy drives the turbulence, and that's a very special turbulence. It allows us, in this particular case, to go to higher Reynolds numbers. And so, anyway, so here's first of all the case without helicity. Here's the power spectrum. The solid line is the magnetic energy, and the magnetic energy decays rapidly. These different lines are separated by powers of 10 in time, so one order of magnitude in time difference. Here you see the evolution at the different wave numbers as a function of time. There's no build up at the largest possible scale. It decays even at the largest possible scale. In the presence of helicity, the situation is very different. Here you see at the largest, first of all, at small scale, it decays, but at the largest scale, it builds up. And you see this very clearly as a function of time. It builds up and eventually decays. And at a higher, for higher resolution, you see the same effect, even more pronounced. So here you see the presence or absence of an inverse magnetic cascade has to do with the presence of magnetic helicity. Second point, what about the dissipation? I am interested in this particular system. What happens to the energy balance? So we start off with a system that has initially only magnetic energy and is then going to decay. Some part of the magnetic energy will be split and will go into driving the kinetic energy, and the other part will go into driving the into just heat, directly into heat, whereas the kinetic energy later on goes also into heat. To my surprise, I find that the ratios, I can measure here, first of all, the rate of transfer, that is the logarithmic derivative with respect to the total energy, that is the derivative of this one, divided by the total magnetic energy and multiplied by the time, is a constant, and this is 0.2 in these cases, approximately something between 1/2 and 1/3 goes into a heat directly by the kinetic energy channel, and a three times larger fraction goes into joule heating directly. Exactly, that's what I thought, and the result is it is actually not. And if you write this in the form, so you see here, these are the different curves for a very different range of Prandtl number. Here is this one of the curves, the dash triple dotted line, the magnetic Prandtl number is 200. And the other extreme case, it is a tenth. I'm not sure I have the 1/10 curve here. Do I have the 1/10 curve? I have the 1/10 curve. And in all cases, it is actually independent. If you write it in the following way, so this is the rate at which, for example, kinetic energy decays divided by the total energy, and that's the crucial thing, multiplied by time. So what this amounts to is the same as saying T times nu times omega squared divided by B squared.
What if you go to the limit of infinite transfer? Zero magnetic difference.
I would expect, I originally thought, that because the viscosity is so extreme, that magnetic energy can be dissipated more efficiently through the viscous channel, but that's not the case. Remains always self-similar. Hubbard. Why not? I mean, I think it just tells us once more that if you change the gradient, if you change the viscosity, you make the gradient smaller. And so you don't really exactly know how much you're getting in the exit channel. And that's exactly what happens. So the rates in that sense. So if you take kinetic energy divided by kinetic energy, kinetic dot divided by E kinetic, then it's no longer true. Then you see a very broad spread. But if you divide by the total energy, then...
This is interesting. It may mean, as you say, that if the magnetic is extremely small, then immediately you relax the situation of current sheet.
It's the viscosity, sorry. Yes, correct. Yes. Now I come to the calculations of force turbulence. Okay. Is that the discussion over? So the following calculations are those that I presented in a poster. I'm showing you the calculation where I start off with the weak power spectrum with weak magnetic energy. The initial magnetic power spectrum is the k to the plus fourth random initial power spectrum. The dashed line over here is k times the magnetic elasticity, and this quantity needs always to be less than the magnetic elasticity. Than the magnetic energy, and it is indeed initially the case. So initially there is some weak magnetic elasticity present, very random. At the next time, it immediately becomes much smoother. It's not the next time, it's already 10 times units later. But now let's, and then you see here how the kinetic energy is driven. The kinetic energy is very much larger. Here is the forcing scale, and you over here, yes, now let's carry on with the calculation. So you see the magnetic energy rises in an almost self-similar fashion. All the scales approximately rise at the same time. Now you begin to reach super equipartition, first of all, goes slightly above on the Heisenberg numbers. And here already at the time 270, the magnetic energy begins to go larger than the kinetic energy, and that carries on. So at this point you see that the dotted line, which is the kinetic energy spectrum, is already less at the larger scale than the magnetic energy. At all other scales, there's equipartition. Now, at the same time, look at the images. These are slices in the calculation. You begin to see some large-scale pattern over here in two of the images, here as well. Here's the maximum in the middle. Here's the maximum 90 degrees phase shifted to the left. There's nothing in the BY image here in this case. And so now as time goes on, and here I've switched to a larger scale, you see that the structure in the flow becomes much more pronounced. In two of the images, you see a very clear sinusoidal spectrum. Now, let's see this whole thing again. Repetition, and now it reaches, you know, it's this large scale structure. The what? The third curve? Okay, this one is the magnetic elasticity. And the magnetic helicity shows an interesting quenching feature. And I think that is part of the reason maybe why not much contribution actually goes to this largest scale. So the magnetic helicity, once the magnetic field is already very strong, begins to be strongly quenched. At earlier times, this looks different. It also fluctuates a lot. And look at this, initially no structure, and even now where it reaches equipartition, still no structure. You don't see this large-scale structure, even though the magnetic energy has already reached equipartition. It happens only later, and it's approximately at this time. And again, you see here. The magnetic energy dominates drastically at large scales, yes, by a factor of two.
Over the yellow means
blue means a different sign. And yellow means the other sign. Plus.
So how about the sign of felicity? Is it all the same sign, the magnetic felicity?
the kinetic electricity injection is positive. That leads to a positive magnetic electricity at the small scales and negative electricity at the large scales. So the large scale field that we have in the end is an almost force-free, fully helical magnetic field configuration. It's negative electricity, and it corresponds to a polarized wave which twists around like so.
In your plot, so have you ever seen negative electricity in your plot?
Yeah. It is only the largest wave number is negative, actually. And so I've plotted the modulus.
Modulus,
yeah.
Is there an energy-dependent
gauge inside? It is gauge-independent, yes, because I'm using periodic boundary conditions. If I add a gradient to the field, then because if B is equal to zero, it's gauge-invariant. Yes. The force, the small scales initially you see are not exactly force free. The force freeness you see by looking at the difference between the solid line and the dashed line. This shows you the departure from force freedom. So at small scales it's initially not force free, and it begins to become more force free towards later times at small scales, but not at the intermediate scales over here. So close. Sorry?
My
time's up. Yes? Fine. Thank you.
I wanted to talk about, I'm actually doing double duty both in the dynamo session and in the inverse cascade session, and so I'm getting a little bit of work in here and then kind of have the spillover kind of go into the inverse into the dynamo session. And this is actually work that we have already done and published in Physics of Plasmas in 1999. This is Balsara and Pouquet, 1999, in Physics of Plasmas, where we studied the inverse cascade of magnetic helicity for the compressible case. And the compressible case is rather interesting because the incompressible case has been hacked to death by people in the plasma physics community. So to start with some preliminaries, which of course everybody has to some extent been told by previous speakers, the magnetic field can always be expressed as a magnetic vector potential because it's a divergence-free field, and so Volter proved that A dot B averaged over the domain is a conserved quantity in ideal MHD. The net result, and so subsequently, about a few years later, Pouquet et al. Who proved that the magnetic helicity actually goes through an inverse cascade process. And one has to ask the question, why is this of interest to astronomy? The reasons for that interest are, first of all, it provides the first hint of dynamo action. That is to say, it suggests that the MHD system is capable of having situations where large-scale magnetic structures build up. Second of all, you have to use the Schwarz inequality to realize that the magnetic helicity divided by the magnetic vector potential is bounded by the magnetic energy. And so this gives one a way of quantifying that if you have a way of increasing magnetic helicity, you also have a simultaneous way of increasing the magnetic energy. So the magnetic energy is, after all, what we're interested in the dynamo problem. And the mean of the magnetic vector potential actually is a very slowly varying quantity, so you can assume that this remains roughly constant. So the magnetic helicity is kind of linked to the magnetic energy. Also, from a spectral point of view, Pouquet et al. Proved that the magnetic helicity has a spectrum that goes, that inverse cascades as k raised to minus 2, and then it's just a matter of using the k vector representation for the magnetic field and the magnetic vector potential to realize that the realizability condition itself suggests that the magnetic energy should go as k raised to minus 1. So that is a very, that is just state setting to kind of help us understand.
There is a second inequality in a bounded system between the magnetic energy and the mean square potential, the function calculus variation. So you really do have a lower bound on magnetic energy in terms of magnetic energy.
That's right. So what we've done is, and this inverse cascade is true both for DK calculations as well as for forced simulations, and we've gone ahead and done both types of calculations. As I mentioned before, this sort of simulation has been done extensively in the fusion devices community for the incompressible case, and we've gone ahead and done a lot of these types of simulations for the compressible case. Now, in the compressible case, you kind of operate under different sorts of strictures, especially when you kind of want to go after real astrophysics, where Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 5 simulations are not unrealistic. And so you have to have numerical methods that are robust under those situations. So what we've done is build up a capability for doing higher order Gardner schemes with this sort of for this sort of problem, and we've applied higher order Gardner schemes to these problems. Now the nice thing about higher order Gardner schemes is that they allow you to get close to the jagged edge before the nonlinearities will kill you. At the same, so you can kind of produce shocks with very thin, narrow, exact structures. So you can kind of do a little better at the higher end, higher wave number end. So here, actually, let's go through this first and then this. We've done simulations which are forced both in the magnetic, in the kinetic part, and also simulations that are to some extent forced in the kinetic as well as the magnetic parts. Here's an example of a strongly forced simulation. So this is a simulation that retains Mach 1 and has fluctuations that go all the way to Mach 3 or Mach 4. And this dotted line shows the time evolution for the magnetic helicity, and this solid line shows the time evolution for the magnetic energy. And you see that indeed, roughly, there is a t raised to 1 kind of increase in the magnetic helicity, which is in accordance with the theories that have been put forward. Also, what you see is that the magnetic energy also kind of goes through a lockstep increase as the magnetic helicity increases, which is kind of consistent with the theory. So that kind of tells us that several of the aspects of the theory, which of course was built for the incompressible regime, carries over nicely into the compressible regime. And this is the reference for January 1999, Physics of Plasmas. And here I show you the evolution of spectra for the magnetic helicity. And this is the driving scale in the simulation. These are 128 cube simulations, but we've done them for the Dynamo problem at 256 cube resolution also. And the interesting thing is that we very rapidly see the development of a small scale spectrum, where this is high wave numbers, this is this is energy increasing upwards, and this is a log-log scale, log-log plot. And what you see is that very rapidly one sees the establishment of a direct cascade, but also more slowly one sees the evolution of an inverse cascade. And there are sufficiently many scales left in this simulation that one can see that a very pronounced and very conclusive inverse cascade also develops in these simulations. Now, the important thing, so the last interesting point that I'll make is that we have also done these simulations in DK mode for a variety of scales on which we kind of imparted magnetic energy. And we verified that indeed the dissipation that was going on in the simulation, that as all simulations will have a certain amount of dissipation, we verified that we were always simulating the as wave numbers that were larger than the wave numbers that would cause dissipation to become a problem in these simulations. So that quantification of how one avoids the jagged edge of, you know, the high dissipation situations in these simulations, which can make these simulations non-ideal, has been successfully avoided and calibrated so that we know how to avoid that edge. So that's the point to make.
You've heard in a number of presentations that there is a need to get rid of the necessity that's building up at large scale. In your simulation, as I understand it, you avoided all dissipation. How did you get rid of the necessity at the wrong time?
We didn't avoid all the dissipation. It was there. On the other hand, we made sure that our forcing scales and the scales that were growing were larger than the scales where dissipation would strongly affect us, so that when we saw the growth of felicity, we could actually trust it.
Eventually, of course, the event was pointing out, the growth of the large field must be limited viscously. Can you check that? Which again, must be tricky, because you don't really have real
viscosity. Eventually, on the small scales, yes, there is a certain amount of effective numerical viscosity which creeps in. But on the large scales, that is not the case, and we've checked that and verified that that is not so. So we've calculated a lot of invariants that need to be preserved and proved that within bounds they indeed stay preserved. This was just started off with random Gaussian fields, but we are forcing these simulations, so of course what you get at the end is vastly different from what you started off with. We do have a certain amount of magnetic helicity, and that cannot be avoided. So we started with that much. We didn't bias towards having a significant amount of magnetic helicity.
How much
what you're seeing is plots that plot out the absolute value of the magnetic helicity. So yes, indeed, it does change sign. Okay. So later on, we'll talk about dynamos within the context of these simulations.
I hope you all understood everything you heard. I'm not sure I do. I can try to just say a few words about each presentation that we heard. Sridhar made an admirable attempt to explain the cascade being anisotropic in K-space, K-perp being cascading much faster than K-parallel, and thus leading to an anisotropic spectrum of energy. And one of the things, of course, that will be of interest is to consider what effects this has, if any, on dynamo calculations that involve integration of the spectrum. I personally don't know when we can come back to that question. Jason showed a very interesting simulation of this theory that Sridhar presented, in which he claims to have verified Goldreich and Sridhar numerically, and then he went on to discuss the case where, if I understood it, V dot V average is not zero, the so-called third helicity or the cross helicity. Is that correct? And is it not correct that E plus minus E minus is equal to this cross list? The two things are related that way, is that right? So if this invariant, B dot B is not zero, something that is usually taken to be zero, E plus can be greater than E minus, or vice versa, and then you get an interesting thing which is being exploited in the solar coronal physics, where you see one energy, E plus, for example, overbalancing E minus as a result, perhaps, of an instability, kind of a runaway situation, where you get only one. I didn't really understand too well the discussion about polarization, because it seems to me that in turbulence in general, the waves will be unpolarized. So I don't see how you could follow that very far.
Mm-hmm. And if they polarize, obviously,
Okay, so again, there's a question of one is being unstable toward the polarization of the other.
Yeah.
Okay? That may even have observable consequences on the solar wind. Let's see, the next notes that I made here. Eve discussed the case of the electron of clouds, where under certain conditions you do expect this anisotropic cascade. If the alternating speed is high, or if the magnetic field is strong. On the other case, if it is not strong, as I understood, then you do expect a more isotropic cascade. Elliot talked about how all of these direct cascades that we've been talking about finally terminate. Of course, there has to be dissipation of some sort. And in a collisionless plasma, you would certainly expect there will be dissipation as you approach the cyclotron resonance. And as he pointed out, that's not really how it happens. The criterion is that the wavelength, this time in a perpendicular direction because of the Golarek-Sridhar cascade, approaches the ion cyclotron radius, which is a very different criterion, if I understood. And at that point, there is a wave-particle interaction which can either be electrical in nature or magnetic in nature. For example, one of them, the transit time damping, corresponds to the fact that there are points along the magnetic field where the field is stronger and therefore the particles are trapped, in a sense, and they can lose energy to the radial wave. And the question was raised, is there some way to parameterize this behavior so that one can get an effective dissipation. Then Ben turned back to the subject of helicity and its consequences for what has been called by Fouquet an inverse cascade. I think we're going to have to decide whether that really is a good good thing to call it. But in any case, the buildup of helicity at a large scale, a small wave number. And he pointed out that if you take into account the precise spectrum of wave number spectrum of the energy cascade for k greater than the input scale, that is in the inertial range, that one could put rather precise limits on alpha, in effect, by integrating properly over the scale, the kind of argument that I brought up this morning. He instead expressed his results in terms of build-up time of the magnetic velocity at large scales, if I understood correctly. Axel showed some fascinating simulations. And if I understood the results, he showed that if you just watch the decay of hydromagnetic turbulence without magnetic velocity, you get decay at all scales. Whereas, if you do have magnetic velocity present, there is very interesting effects. The short scales decay, the large k wave number is do decay rapidly, but instead of decaying, the long wavelengths grow in intensity. Very interesting effect. He also claimed to have shown that independent of the magnetic Pronto number, as I understood it, the dissipation goes through, you'll have to say, goes through the magnetic channel or the distance channel.
The equal contribution always, independent of the Pronto number. So 1/3 roughly, depending on the density, maybe, in the kinetic, and otherwise,
but an unexpected result, perhaps, that you might expect the Prandtl number, the ratio of dissipations, of dissipation scales, to enter into this energy argument. He then showed what amounted, or what I see as a kind of wave of helicity developing in a situation where there is kinetic helicity. And the curves that he showed there are very similar to those that were calculated in an approximate way by Fouquet in 1976. And I think what's happening, myself, is that one can explain, and you should comment on this, Axel, but from our discussion, it seems to seem that what's happening is that there is a, what was called by Fouquet et al. The residual torsality, which we haven't introduced in the discussion, but it's basically the difference between the two terms that I showed in alpha. One of them is the traditional tau beta omega, and the other one, other sign, of tau j dot b. And there is such a term as a result of the way the flow is set up. And I think the term that is important in his simulations is the first one, namely the kinetic velocity. That is the contribution that counts in the alpha effect. And as a result, the alpha effect is in effect acting like a pump, pumping the helicity from the large K to the small K. And that, as we explained this morning, that has to be dissipated in order for this to continue. And what makes me think that is that the peak of the magnetic velocity buildup at small k is simply growing in accordance with the following idea, that it's growing exponentially at a rate which is k alpha t. K being the local wave number, alpha being the helicity at the driving wavelength. And that is simply a alpha squared diamond. That's exactly what we expect. And so I do think that from today's paper, which he has another explanation, may not be correct. Balserat showed us that the whole process carries over into the compressible case, which is certainly of great importance for this study. So shall we have a discussion now, or how do you want to end
up? I'd like to move forward. There's only one number for relation, especially one part, and you can't break it up into a spectrum. It's not taking very
much. Then a closed box is it?
No, you can add on a grad pi.
But the point is that because it's gradient, all I can say is that there is a long paper by Dylan Matthews addressing this point. And he said it's okay.
Oh, you should be
the large magnetic field, because it interacts in and out with the small magnetic field. It's two tails of a lot. It's contribution. It's really hard to tell where the criminals have the large and small magnetic connection.
I think that I would agree with you, George, that it is easy to grasp. That that graph by terms does not contribute to the
one number, which is the integral of the mind.
Even the average.
But it changes the spectrum. I mean, you just take a pause. It changes
But these are my T cross AK, and that will always not, that will not contribute to, if you put item text in this section itself, there will be some.
Thank you, Ben.
I myself have written a paper on the data, but I'm sort of over with you.
I can see Carlos there asking, what does this have to do with the field of the
alpha? I think it's that the alpha effect, if it exists, is a very important part of generating the field of the alpha. The other one is the stretching of the field lines in the toroidal direction. So we're interested in how this alpha effect works. Any other?
Unrelated observations.
Oh, unrelated observations. Okay.